The San Antonio Spurs have been the benchmark of culture and high performance in the NBA for over 20 years. Sure, they've won championships, but it's the manner in which they have conducted themselves over those years, both on and off the floor, that makes it so special. So what's the secret? We spoke to Jordan Colosi, VP of Business Strategy and Innovation at the Spurs, who gave some insight into their success. We covered a lot of ground, and honestly, we probably could have gone for another hour or two, but we did cover the compulsory leadership-based training that they do, their unrelenting focus on data and innovation to improve every season, and how they digitally engage with their very diverse and international fan base. Jordan gave us an incredible peek behind the curtain of one of the best-run organisations in the country, and I'm truly grateful that we can all take some of these learnings and apply them in our own businesses, big and small. Anyway, lots of gold in here, so grab a notebook, grab a pen, you won't want to miss a moment. You are listening to the Engage Nation podcast. Here's Jordan. Okay, Jordan, thanks very much for jumping on the show. Really excited to hear about the ins and outs of the Spurs and what makes a pretty famous franchise and a pretty famous culture work in the world of innovation and strategy and all of the above. So first off, thanks for jumping on, mate.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, really looking forward to this. Thanks for reaching out for this chat.
No worries. So let's get stuck in. Let's hear a bit about your background. You know, what got you to this point? Start at the beginning, if you'd like.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it started when I was in business school. I had played basketball in college and I was in grad school and kind of was tailing the end of my basketball career. I had to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I took an internship in Raymond James Financial Institution in my hometown of St. Petersburg, Florida. And it was, you know, it was the classic cubicle fluorescent light office setting. And I just, you know, thought to myself, this isn't really for me. This doesn't fit with my trajectory forward. And I was talking with the person overseeing the internship, and he just highlighted, you need to do what you love. It's going to be your life's work. You're going to, you know, when work from home wasn't quite a thing, you're going to be spending as much time with these people that at work as you will with your family, because you're just going to be here all the time. So you got to really love what you do. And with that, I went home and thought of the coolest thing I could think of, which growing up being a kid in the 90s in Central Florida was go to work for the Orlando Magic. Obviously, the Shaq and Penny years with the Orlando Magic left a pretty big impression. Through some, you know, personal contacts I had made, was able to get an internship. Internship turned into a full-time role. Full-time role turned into a career. So been off to the races since then.
Amazing. So what's it like working when it's basically your hobby and something you're so passionate about? Some people will say that, you know, working in your passion is sort of a dangerous game, because you might end up like not liking parts of it, and you're like, oh man, is this my passion? If you come across, well, everyone's had hard days of work, right? Even if you're working at an NBA team, yeah. And days you go, oh geez, I didn't like that. Have you ever come across that? Have you managed that at all, or even thought about it?
Yeah,
you know, it's just awesome.
Yeah, it's all expectation and perception, right? Like, you know, you get in your own situation. And I think, you know, a lot of folks get into sports because they, you know, see the athletes and they see these big brands they see on TV and they want to associate with it. They want to, you know, cover themselves and be as close to that. They want to brand themselves with that brand as much as possible. I guess what it comes down to me in working in sports and why I love it is, you know, you work those hard days in the office, things don't seem to be going right, whatever, just the stuff that happens in life. And then coming up from the office and there's an event that's and doors are open and fans are pouring in and you see like a father and his daughter walking in and they're about to like share this like awesome memory together for this event that you put together. And this is something they're going to remember for a long time. It's going to bring them closer together. So I think the effect that this work has on other people and how they relate to each other is really where I draw a lot of the inspiration. More than probably some of the what might be more surface level or obvious about the cool parts about it, which are definitely there and are definitely nice. But I think it's, you know, it comes down to is it fulfilling what you need? And for some people, I have no doubt, that can run its course.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's true. With your work in sport or any organization, you know, you got to find your why. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
Okay.
So take us into the front office at the Spurs, mate. And what's a week look like? What's a day look like? Because and does that change a great deal whether you're in season or off season? Is there natural cycles based on that? Give us some insight there. It'd be great.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think coming to the Spurs from other professional sports organizations, obviously. I was with the Orlando Magic and learned a great deal about brand building. We went through a whole brand relaunch while I was there. Had some pretty high heights with team performance while I was there as well. So I got to experience a lot of that fun kind of new team, new energy. Then went to the Nashville Predators, learned a lot about just how to sell, ice hockey in Central Tennessee and really brand build, sell in a difficult market and really understand how to build a value proposition where, the sports itself might not necessarily be obvious how to build it and explain that and lean into your strengths and play to your strengths. So that was a very valuable time I spent there. But coming to the Spurs, it's obvious just the excellence that this organization has exuded for an extended period of time. And I think there's a lot of cultural, very intentional elements that the organization bakes in to folks who they're grafting kind of, I know a lot of groups refer to their front offices family. But honestly, there is a common language that needs to be understood, a common culture that needs to be understood in order to fully respect and understand, the excellence that this organization has achieved. It's intentional, it's thoughtful. I think once you have gone through the very intentional trainings, you've taken classes, they call you value-based leadership training, which is mandatory trainings that you go through, then you kind of have this toolkit for understanding yourself, understanding others, diagnosing situations beyond people and understanding the root and basically not... There's a saying that goes essentially, if your problem has a name, if your problem is a person, then you're in the middle of what's known as the drama triangle. And you need to live outside of the drama triangle and understand what are the situational elements that are resulting in this friction. It's not embodied and personified. So I think just understanding that's the confluence of how the organization works is super important. I think from a tactical standpoint, obviously we strive to be champions in everything we do and in multiple meanings of that word. So obviously there's the championships that the organization has won in the past. The success of the Spurs. We also have a USL, which is a minor league soccer team, just brought home the trophy for the USL. We've within the past several years won the G League championship with our G League team up in Austin. So I think that level of on field, on court excellence is there, but also in our business performances as well, we strive to be best in class.
So you sort of talked about the value-based leadership training that's compulsory, which is brilliant. What are the values that the Spurs have? Oftentimes, values, as a team, you might do the values and then you'll stick them on the wall and everyone walks past them every day. But if you ask someone, they wouldn't know what it is.
Yeah.
That's a classic one in sort of larger organizations. But you have to live your values. What are the Spurs ones and where do you see them in action at a really granular level?
No, I think that's well said. You need to have a driving principle behind those. It's nice to have gone through the exercise and built the value statements. But, I think it kind of comes back to the Stonecutter's Creed, which is really at the heart of the organization, which it's a Jacob Rice quote, which is essentially, you boil it down to, when nothing seems to help. I think of a stonecutter hard at work, pounding a rock, 99 times with not so much as a crack, but on the 100th time, the rock splits wide open. And he knows that it wasn't the one hit at the end that broke the rock, but the 99 that came before it. So really, it is really focusing on knowing what your North Star is, knowing what is the right thing to be doing, and really living that every day, regardless of the specific day to day, not getting caught in immediate outcomes. We talk about, we have difficult days at the top of the call. But everyone goes through those. It's in those moments, are you able to hold tight to what your values are? Ours are integrity, success, and caring that we've really wrapped around. That's the plaque on the wall for us, but how are we living it? We're living it every day, knowing that when the success comes, it isn't because of that one last little stretch that we took that got us there. It was living that every day, the integrity, success, and caring every day. So
that's great. Amazing to hear. And, you know, it does show, I mean, even from the outside looking in, and this is, the players on the court, you can see they're living it, let alone all the staff in the office as well. That's, it's evident. And it's pretty famous now, I'd say, amongst the team. So yeah, congratulations to you and everyone on that. And I'd like to hear about how that shows up from an innovation perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So when every year, right, you might have had a really successful year in every metric you want to measure. And then you sort of sit down with the team, you celebrate for half a second, and then the next day you come in, you go, righto team, we're going again. How do we get 1% better? You know, how do we get, you know, what's the next thing? What's the next level? Take us into that part of the world, your world and the teams you work with and across the business, I suppose, as well.
You know, it comes down to, in our area, we're a relatively new function within the organization. So, you know, on the heels of a lot of that sustained success, I think, and in understanding how the market is moving, and you see the size of these player salaries now and just the revenue numbers that we need to hit as an organization, in a relatively smaller market with just a lower corporate base than potentially other markets that have professional sports teams and are selling these, we need to be very smart and intentional with how we activate, where we're activating to provide that value and be able to compete for those top tier players, you know, in order to continue to function as the top tier organization that we expect ourselves to. So that was the introduction, the inception of creating a formalized analytics department within Spurs Sports and Entertainment. And I'll say that when I came down, a lot of the data decisions, a lot of the data infrastructure was built a bit on an ad hoc basis. It was created in order to serve a specific purpose, but those decisions weren't necessarily made in conjunction with each other. And so there was no fluid motion of how your data was being represented. It was only being activated, used, collected, activated in a complete silo. And I think that drove some business functions to operate in a silo. And so, you know, first order of business coming in was to try to establish that data, that core center of where all data lives, try to begin to audit and move through our data silos that had formed and break those down, understand the how the technology or endpoint products were being used that were generating the data, and see if there were multiple uses or there was other services that could be scaled across the organization. I think form data collection, we were on, you know, three or four different vendors for that. I think from a CRM standpoint, there were three or four different, you know, CRMs being used internally. How do we get everyone in the same platform, standardize business processes, create, you know, rules to engage customers, and so we can be thoughtful and show up as one organization to the customer. And from there, once you begin to have that solid core, solid foundation, you begin to build from there, and then you can get into more abstract, strong data sets and start, you know, forecasting with a lot more specificity and dynamicism as you begin to activate your data. And I think that's only continuing to scale as now you see AI coming into the situation where we're seeing if what data sets we have to begin to feed into to AI opportunities that can help supplement frontline staff and service fans with better, more dynamic, always on type feedback mechanisms and responses. So, you know, I think you need to get organized, you need to be thoughtful, just as thoughtful as the organization has been with its culture and decisions that it makes, how it carries itself. You know, we carry that forward into what we try to do from a data analytics standpoint and data operations standpoint. From an innovation, you know, standpoint, I think, you know, that's another big word like analytics. It can mean a million different things depending on the context. We're also in the currently in the process of kind of an overhaul of our strategy, our business strategy. I think coming out of COVID, a realization after that pause that it's probably time to refresh some of our focus and what's going to get us to that next level and then allow us to continue to compete with markets that are much, much larger than ours, much more affluent than ours, in San Antonio. And, you know, once we understand what our business objectives are and what we're trying to achieve over the long term, only then can we really understand where our time is best invested from an innovation standpoint. And once we begin to diagnose areas of priority, then we can begin to form hypotheses and then test and learn against those. So really kind of implementing a human-centered design approach to how we implement strategy. So you don't need a perfect beta product in order before fans see it. You need something that helps the core and is at the core essentially what it is you're trying to achieve or learn about. Get it out and allow fans to interact with it, engage with it. You know, obviously with the proper preface that this is something we're trying out. What do you think? You know, tell me about your reaction. What should this have? And learn alongside, bring fans and customers into that process with you. And you're going to end up somewhere you never would have if you were just sitting behind the scenes, crunching numbers in a spreadsheet. You're out in the real world. You're trying, you're learning, you're testing, you're failing, you're learning, you're adapting. And that's really where the coolest, most exciting type of innovation happens.
Awesome. I mean, there's so much gold there. I've got to pick one. I'll pick one part of that. I was on getting the customer involved in you know what is in effect, you know, probably an MVP of sorts, and getting them in the room. It reminds me of the Jeff Bezos sort of mindset where you got to have they leave one chair in the room empty. It's always for any meeting they have, and it's always for the customer. And I think that's quite because you can picture it, something. It's quite visual, I suppose. But it's also they probably literally do it. But I think it's what you guys are doing is bang on. Can you give us a practical example of where you've did that? So you might have trialed something and you got their feedback, and then it might have taken you down a different track, or you're like, oh, actually, we're kind of pretty close. You know, was there something that you tried that you could give us some insight into where that happened?
Yeah, we're working through something right now. It's I was actually working on it earlier today, so it's the first thing that pops into my mind where. We made an observation that we had a disproportionate number of fans trying to enter the building just on one side, based on how our scan rates were moving. We also were getting some feedback that wasn't necessarily the best way to start their experience was standing in a long queue trying to get into the arena. So. There were a lot of concepts around activations that we could do surrounding the facility and just some of the different spaces. We actually brought a good cross section of the organization and kind of broke them into different groups and kind of ideated, okay, what can we do that will help enhance the fans' experience pregame proactively in order to maybe head off this experience that isn't going the direction that we want to, and we don't have this negative first impression. Right, as people are trying to get in. The concept that ended up being selected to move on from that broader group was this activation plaza with different elements. And it was along the path of journey for those fans coming in. And it was literally coming out of that conversation. It was, you know, a two, three hour session from beginning to end. So it was an investment. It was just a hand-drawn prototype of this is how it might work, right? And so now we had that artifact, and we can take that hand-drawn artifact and say, okay, business operations, facility operations, culinary, everything. Like, what do you think of this? And it was like, oh, well, that's actually a fire zone. We need to keep that safe. So, and oh yeah, we don't really have the permits to do some of the stuff there, but we do have this other space over here that's kind of underutilized. So we kind of got back the group back together that ended up coming up with that concept, moved through, and we decided to activate this other space and maneuver some things to shift some of the fans going to this other plaza and event. And we did some intercept surveys around some of that real world, kind of recalibrated version, kind of second or third version of the prototype. And from there, we've gotten a lot of great feedback of, we actually have shifted, you know, it's, you know, 2-3% of the total door scans move from one to the other, right? But that's not nothing. And it's literally, it hasn't cost us anything at this point. It's literally just us working with an internal group, getting feedback, adjusting, pivoting, acting in some feasible way that doesn't cost us any money, just shifting assets around, learning that, hey, we can shift behavior. When we pull these levers, stuff starts to move and shift. You know, that didn't work, but this did, you know, shifting online sales from this lot to this lot, even within in the run-up to the game, does move behavior. We ended up selling, you know, it increased per caps in that like run up to the game in that area by, you know, I think it was like $4 or $5. So, I mean, it was, well, I should say that's closer to 10%. So 10% increase in per caps in that area. So, I mean, it was good. It was a win all the way around, and we're going to continue to iterate, and we're not going to be done. And I think that's actually leading to some insights of how do we use the one entrance that everyone's trying to go through, because there's some activation elements that may be slowing people down and not processing people as quickly through that large entrance. And how do we get folks who are interested in standing around and maybe watching the dance team do their thing, or sit and listen to the DJ, or if there's a band set out there or whatever elements, or we decided to use the program. Let's take those people who are interested in standing around, having experience, getting a beer, getting food, over to a different area, and then really understanding, you know, Amazon has the one chair that they have available. I think acknowledging that, you know, different groups of fans come to our arena for different reasons, and diversifying the offering. You know, some folks just want to get in the building as quickly as possible because there's something that they're trying to accomplish, or they want to go see the players and shoot around. That's why they came early. Other folks are interested in sitting around, having a beer, talking, maybe seeing some live music as almost a differentiated experience from the game itself. Knowing the difference, having the offering, and the diversification of that, understanding that not every fan is made the same, and not every fan is looking for the same thing.
Maybe you need a few more chairs, empty chairs in the
pool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How big's your room?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Really interesting. Great insight. Thanks for that. I want to jump into the NBA teams, sort of the other NBA teams potentially who work in the same space as you, almost like a fraternity of teams where you sort of will share some things you might be coming across, or ideas, or, you know, how willing are you? Obviously competitive on the court, you know, want to kill each other on the court, but is it totally different in the front office, or are you kind of keep your cards close from a team to team perspective?
You know, we've had a lot of talks. There is a separate analytics and strategy group on the team side from the business side. And I think you're kind of touching on kind of why some of that is, you know, I think on the team side, those groups are competing for any advantage that they can give their team, their GM as they're building their teams and finding new talent, et cetera. So a lot of their research work is very bespoke and very top secret. Whereas, you know, on the business side, the NBA really is the center, and there's a lot of, there's a lot of mechanisms for revenue sharing across teams from a business performance standpoint, mechanisms that draw that. And I think traditionally, the way that the NBA and North American pro sports teams in general have approached, in my mind, have been built around maximizing each team's regionality and helping each team extract as much regionally as they can, and to help ensure that all franchises are as healthy as possible, because the league benefits with a large number of healthy, well-funded teams, just from an interest standpoint. So, you know, there are a lot more constraints on North American pro sports teams than put on, you know, some of the international soccer clubs that you might be familiar with. So, for example, if you draw a circle 75, 100 miles around each building where teams play, that's generally what's considered their market, their advertising market, or had been. Obviously, when social media and websites and digital came around, that, you know, the cat might not have been out of the bag, was starting to get pretty squirrely in there. And then, you know, I think now the league has shifted its sights to growing internationally, and you can feel, you know, the league and the tension around how do we shift our business model on a dime when we've been so regionally focused and tried to use these franchises to and protected them regionally from each other, to help maximize revenue and allow them to now compete against each other from a business standpoint, potentially internationally. Now, the world's a big place and there's probably enough room for all of us to play somewhere, right? So that's kind of the interesting, fascinating problems that, I wouldn't say problems, challenges that are coming down the pike for us as a league, is how do we shift that mindset to be more global, allowing each team as a brand to activate, to learn. Because that's really, and to go back to, I think, to your initial question, yes, we idea share with other teams all the time. Like, best practices are active. There's a whole department within the NBA built for assisting the dissemination of best practices across different teams. And so that highly staffed department. And so, you know, now that the teams are beginning to compete with each other, that benefit to kind of the federated approach where every team's doing it a little bit differently, you can try a bunch of different ideas. It's an experiment with 30 different teams, and you see what's happening, what works the best and in what context, and that can be quickly adopted, and the rising tide continues to grow for the league. That's going to look a little different potentially. I don't know that for sure.
Spurs have always been probably pioneered, you know, the access to international players on a playing perspective. You know, some of the great, you know, Manu Ginobili, Tim Duncan technically is from the Virgin Islands. I don't know if you count that. You know, you've got, and then you've got Tony Parker, you know, Boris Diaw. You had a team just as about, I think it was like eight international players, which is, I think, probably still the most. Yeah, which is crazy. And they were good. They were really good. And so that really sparked the whole thing. I'd be interested to know, international fans are probably not attached to a city. Like, you know, obviously if you live in San Antonio, you know, you're attached to the city and therefore the Spurs. These fans would be attached to a player. How difficult, and what's the strategy around trying to hang on to them as a, let's call it a Spurs fan? I'll use Patty Mills as an example because he's an absolute legend and we love him. He left the Spurs.
Yeah, we love him. Yeah.
Sorry, what was that?
Still nothing but love for Patty Mills in San Antonio, for sure.
Yeah. I think he was a bit of a hit. And he left. And I, you know, let's imagine that, you know, you lost probably a few Australian fans to his new team, to Brooklyn. How do you counter that? You know, what's the strategy around trying to make them sticky Spurs fans rather than Patty Mills fans?
Right. And I think, you know, some of this comes down to how is the NBA more broadly showing up in the Australian market? So what does losing those fans not allow us to do that we were able to do before? And the revenue stream. So, you know, there's the NBA League Pass, and there's some other mechanisms for Australian fans to access Spurs content, for example. There's the NBA team store. You know, I think both of those revenue sources, by the way, end up finding their way into some version of the NBA revenue sharing pool that the broader, you know, each team gets to share from. And, you know, I think then you begin to look at social media numbers, and, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, if you talk to teams who haven't scrolled through other teams' performance, you know, you're moving over to the Philippines, just for a quick second, millions and millions of followers. Most teams have millions and millions of followers in the Philippines on social media. And I think the answer is, what do you do with that? A, and then like B, they're likely how, like, if you add all of those people together, there's more people than the population of the Philippines. So what is likely occurring is a lot of folks in the Philippines are following multiple teams, right? Because they're fans of the NBA more broadly. So I to answer your question, I think that's kind of what we were talking a little bit about before, of what is the team, how does the NBA, how are teams approaching this new reality as we try to expand internationally beyond just the league structure. Now, that said, I think there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, fan clubs and the fans that currently exist there to help be that anchor. Because going back to, you know, the beginning of the call, why I got into sports in the first place, and I think is a consistent thread through a lot of what we see, you know, our persona research and differentiating, trying to identify those groups of fans. We said there needs to be multiple chairs in the room, going back to the Amazon example. Well, we've identified at least five that live in our market. But the thing that each of those five, and there's probably infinite more, right, archetypes, is that they're trying to use our brand to connect with other people. Now, who those people are in relation to them is that is where the magic happens. And so as we look to international markets, carrying some of that philosophy forward, how can we enable someone who happens to be a Spurs fan? Maybe they spent time in San Antonio, maybe they had a dear friend who did that passed on their fandom, to kind of help be that anchor for us and begin to inspire a community around it. I think, you know, you see this a lot with the English Premier Leagues, and you see bars where the supporters will gather with like-minded people and around this brand that they all have in common. And now they're able to connect more freely and build it. It's actually one of my favorite TED Talks is How to Start a Movement. It's really short. If you haven't seen it, I suggest you look it up. But it essentially... Yeah, essentially the punchline is, you know, as you're starting a movement, the most important person isn't the lone crazy person dancing on a hill. It's the first person to go alongside that person and start dancing with them to model the behavior of how to be.
I've seen that video. Sorry, John, I haven't seen the TED Talk, but I've seen that video where the dude's just dancing and then, yeah, that first person, right? And then all of a sudden, everyone's brave.
Right. Well, yeah, it shows, yeah, they're modeling how to follow this movement. And so empowering those folks would seem to be a key part of how you activate those groups, begin to create those communities. And you can move those values. And as long as you have something important, relevant to say, then that's all it's all people are looking for, right? Is how to connect and how to identify themselves, how to differentiate themselves too, not necessarily make themselves separate, but just, this is why I'm a little bit different. but I'm also part of this community. It's just funny how psychology works in that respect.
Just going to cross promote to an article I'm writing at the moment, actually, on sort of the tribalism of sports.
No, right.
So, you know, because it just touches on so many of those themes. You know, what makes, you know, a Buffalo Bills fan jump off his car through a turntable with everyone like screaming, you know, Bills Mafia and stuff? Because, and you know, what makes them camp out overnight in freezing Buffalo? And you know, because the tailgate's the next morning, you know, what makes people do that? If you can figure out what that is, and then, you know, ultimately use, and this is where I'm tying it into some technology here around, you know, fan power and, you know, the use of technology to really advance that. And, you know, fans have more power than they've probably ever had. They have so much sway. You know, what is it about, you know, you being part of a group that really draws back to that sort of the need for connection, right? Which is kind of what you talked about.
No, and we're actually in market with a behavioral economist role right now for that very reason. Normal research is super valuable. You need feedback. You need to gather that feedback. You need to listen to it, take it seriously. Not always literally, but you can take it seriously and aggregate it together, right? But I think there's still an element where at a certain level, you know, humans aren't always the best at telling you exactly what they really want or what they really need in clear terms. Sometimes they're describing symptoms of what they need. You know, I think it goes back to the Henry Ford quote. If I had asked people what they wanted, they would ask for a faster horse, right? Like, it's not no concept of what a car is. But the learning is I want to get from here to there faster, right? And so, someone who is able to help structure that type of research and really upskill us as we're figuring out what those levers, what are those buttons to push that excite in the best possible ways our fandom and ignite that excitement, and obviously minimize the places where we can really blow it the biggest and where to minimize that downside as well.
Mate, we're getting close to this is so interesting. We'll probably keep going for an hour, but you know, people have got busy days. Like you. When you're sort of creating a community of fans, you know, and this is what it touches on, I suppose, is some communities that are really overly manufactured by someone, you know, that might, you know, like the Spurs, say you created a community that is clearly run by the Spurs, as opposed to a fan-owned one. How do you get around they feel like they can say whatever they'd like, not whatever they'd like, but whatever, you know, have open conversations as opposed to something that's really sort of not forced fun, but, you know, it is sort of, you know, they've got the freedom to have conversations and feel a part of the community, especially on, I'm talking about online, especially right in today's day and age, you know, how do you dance that line between, you know, this is still ours, but you guys, you know, run by the fans for the fans.
Right. You know, and I do think, our goal is to try to allow, because not every, going back to what motivates people, I think there's a certain element of, I just want to go to this place and get what I want from it and achieve my goal. And so I'm sure that there are a lot of fans that would want control of a lot of elements, but I do think that there is a balance to be struck with folks just want to go to a game and watch and have a great experience with whoever, or maybe the person's not even there. Maybe they're doing it just for the ritual. Cause I'll highlight, you know, shout out to the fans who come because they came with their grandfather and they're just reliving this ritual as a way to pay homage. Cause that's a thing. Right. So I hear you on like the fan owned part of it. And I think that that's an extremely powerful thing where fans can vote and change. And I think that it's important to take that fan buy-in to open the gates of this is how you provide feedback and your feedback is taken earnest and seriously activated on and implemented. But, you know, I think just the way our mechanisms are built, it's almost as a service to the fan of, you know, we're the ones who are going to have to activate it for you so that whenever you're here, you're able to just immerse yourself in the experience and not have to worry about the operations of how the magic's happening, for better or worse. That approach is a unique one. It's powerful, but is that the way to get that mass fandom? Is that what large groups of fans want? Potentially, I think we would just need to look into it more to understand more about it. I do think that there's a lot of power in the idea of building a platform where we're not controlling everything, but we're allowing individuals to build around and on us on top of what the mechanisms we have. So you think of the iPhone and the creativity that that has unleashed from an app development standpoint, or you think of Airbnb and the creativity from a rental space that individuals are able to monetize and benefit from. Obviously, in each of those innovations iterations end up making the platform itself better and people more likely to go back. The good ideas live, the bad ideas die, and the platform continues to go and refine and be a better version of itself over time. Now, how do we make our game day experience, our fan experience, more like an iPhone, Android app store, or Airbnb, VRBO, you know, we're allowing folks and our fans to benefit financially or otherwise from their creativity on this foundation that we've built. I think that's super fascinating. If anyone cracks that, I think it's off to the races. Instead of having to try to curate and be in the culinary business and the retail style business and and a lot of the sub experiences that surround the game day itself, I think you could build something pretty powerful and to your point, something that fans can own and have an ownership in and directly benefit from.
Man, we have to do a part two on that one because you'd have to a meritocracy is probably where that all this new emerging technology is sort of headed, right? And if fans feel like they have authorship and have lent a hand in creating something, then rather than it being built for them, I mean, that's probably how you crack it. And with some of there's now, I was also reflecting as well when you were speaking, I'm like, I'm sure the fans of the Spurs are pretty happy with the way the Spurs are run. But if you're a fan of owner of Team X, that, you know, never dips in, never pays players a great deal, lets them walk because he's worried about his or her bottom line, then, you know, the fans are going to be like, I feel like I wish I had a bit more control here. And that's where you might start looking at some of these DAO-owned sports teams where they've got, you know, a little bit more say in the inner workings and it's all really transparent. But as I said, Jordan, I think that's probably a whole nother episode, mate. So if you're happy to jump on another one in a few months, we'll do that.
Yeah, I'll drop a business plan between here and there.
Awesome. You can drop it live in front of a live audience or something for us.
My end of the DAO now. Yeah, it'll be a part podcast, part infomercial for our sports DAO.
We'll whip up a landing page. We'll get people to sign up beforehand. Sounds good.
Love it.
Jordan, thank you so much for your time, mate. It's been such an interesting chat. Thanks for letting us get inside the organization a little bit at the Spurs. It's world class and you've been brilliant. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed another episode of the Engage Nation podcast. If you did, we'd love it if you hit follow for us and subscribe. This thing is only going to grow. We're going to get more brilliant guests. We've got them lined up already and the support from you would help us out a lot. And if you want to consume even more content from EngageRM, the world of sports and entertainment technology, sign up to our monthly newsletter, engagerm.com/thecrowd.